Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin with us both hours today. There'll probably be a little groovy music involved. It's Ask Me Anything, so you can call and ask whatever you would like. 888-318-7884. 888-318-7884. Ask Me Anything is open to anyone. There's really no limits. Whatever you'd like to talk about with Jimmy Akin, wherever you're calling from, just call. We'd love to talk with you. 888-318-7884. Jimmy is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, the author of The Bible is a Catholic Book, The Fathers Know Best, Teaching with Authority, A Daily Defense, and many, many other things. Jimmy Akin, thank you for being here with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Cy Kellett. How you doing?
Really good. Really good. Any more books coming?
Oh, of course. Always.
Yeah. You always got something cooking.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Is it top secret until it comes out? Is that how you work?
I can't talk about this any further.
All right. You know it's about UFOs, though. You know it's going to be either demons or aliens. I know it. 888-318-7884 is the number. You are very welcome to call. And today is Friday. There's lots of reasons to enjoy a good Friday. You know, it's just a wonderful day of the week. But you know the most important reason to enjoy your Friday? Because a new episode of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World drops. And you can talk about that.
Oh, yeah. It dropped.
All right, Jimmy. It's going to be one of those days. And what is it?
You want me to talk about it?
I was kind of hoping, yeah.
Well, you know what? You know what it says in the Book of James? You have not because you ask not. Yeah, if you want to know, ask. So this week's episode of Mysterious World is part two of a two-part look at the USS Hornet. The USS Hornet was a ship that served remarkably well and surprisingly safely during World War II. And it also had a prominent role in like the Korean War and during the Vietnam War and the space program. It's where it retrieved the astronauts when they came back from the moon. And then after it was decommissioned, it was going to be sold off for scrap, but there was enough interest to start a charitable foundation to try to preserve it. And people working with the charitable foundation began to report strange things happening on the ship. And a lot of them eventually concluded that the ghosts of the sailors who had served on the ship were back and were helping to try to get it made a permanent museum.
Whoa.
And they're still there today. And they have a chain of command, and there are a whole bunch of ghostly activities being reported on the ship. And so last week we introduced the Hornet. We played a video from about 25 years ago of research that was being done about the ghosts on the ship. And in this week's episode, I interview one of the principal investigators of those ghostly activities. So it's not like an ordinary apparitional situation where you have one spirit of a departed person, either a saint or a soul in purgatory or something that's appearing.
Right.
You've got a whole community of ghosts aboard. At least that's the report. And so if you want to hear about what that's like, you can check it out at my YouTube channel, youtube.com/Jimmy Akin. Or you can go to any of the standard podcast apps, or you can go to mysterious.fm.
Check it out. The Hornet mystery, a two-parter. And if you're thinking, what's just Mysterious World thing about? More than 300 episodes there now at Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. So you're in for a treat if you haven't been there before. Line's almost full, just one line open. If you'd like to fill it, you're welcome to call 888-318-7884. Colin is in Newfoundland, Canada. We'll start with Colin. Welcome, Colin. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Thanks, guys. Sure. If someday we develop science fiction-style longevity technologies which could stop people from aging and allow them to live indefinitely, would these the use of these technologies ever be moral in any situations?
Well, why would they not be moral?
I could imagine that it could cause problems in terms of populations, in terms of the natural course of human life, potentially depending on how the technologies work, if they would hinder some natural function of the body while maintaining its being alive. I could see some possible ways that it could be immoral.
Well, you're adding to the situation. I mean, the question as phrased was, we develop a technology that will let people live indefinitely. Is it moral to use that? Now you're introducing new factors, like this technology has some kind of effects that are immoral on the human bodily function. So, well, if you're building a technology that immorally affects human bodily function, well, then it's not going to be moral to use that. But that's not the same thing. The technology initially asked about was one that that just lets people live indefinitely. So without introducing new factors, can you think of any reason why it would be immoral to have a technology that lets people live indefinitely?
Not off the top of my head.
Yeah, neither can I. God doesn't have a problem with us inventing medicines and techniques and technologies to extend human life. And so given that, there doesn't appear to be anything that would prevent us from being able to morally elicit one that's more open-ended. You know, if you have a technology that'll let someone get past a medical crisis and, say, have another 5 years of life, that's fine. If you then invent a technology that'll let them extend the human lifespan by another 5 years, that's fine. If it's another 10 years, that's fine. If it's another 20 years, that's fine. If it's indefinitely, that's fine. Unless there's some competing factor that that results in a fundamentally immoral situation that cannot be gotten around by anything other than not using the life extension technology, then there's nothing wrong with using life extension technology, regardless of how far it might extend life.
Okay, Colin?
Nice. Thank you, Master Akin.
No problem.
Padawan. A lot of the technology involves, I think, paintings that age. You get a painting that ages, and then you don't age anymore. At least that's how I've heard.
Oh, that's such a gray attitude, you know.
Oh, what's up? Let's do another question. We get another question in before the break. Tyler's in West Bend, Wisconsin, watching on YouTube. Tyler, welcome. Go ahead with your question.
Good to be with you guys. My question was, when St. Paul writes in Romans 10, verse 13, anyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved, what does he mean when he writes that?
Well, in context, in Romans 10, he's making a point about how God is merciful both to Jews and Gentiles. Now, the original quotation about whoever calls on the name of the Lord will be saved, that's from Joel. And so it has a different context in Joel. But basically, it means what you would think it means in Joel. You know, if someone calls on the name of the Lord, then they're going to be delivered from, you know, the problems that they otherwise would face. They're going to be saved from those problems. In Romans, though, Paul is applying the principle in a different context, and he's talking here not about salvation from temporal difficulties, but salvation to eternal life. And he's saying that that's going to be available on to both Jews and Gentiles. Whoever calls on the name of the Lord, whoever believes in Jesus, that person will be saved. And so that's the essential meaning of what he's going for in Romans 10. Does that help?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
All right.
No problem.
Thank you very much. That does take us to the break. We'll take that break. Be right back with more Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Catch Catholic Answers Live anytime at Catholic.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite Monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
This is Conversations with Consequences, where we delve deeper into issues affecting our church, our country, and our core, the family.
As Catholics, we need to be informed, aware, and able to talk through some of the tough topics that we're facing in our culture and in our world. Conversations with Consequences gives us the tools to do so.
It's not enough to pray. We have to be a light for the world.
Conversations with Consequences, tomorrow at 5 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin is our guest. One line open. It's Ask Me Anything, 888-318-7884. Jimmy will be one of the featured speakers at our conference in September, September 25th through 28th, out here in sunny San Diego. Our keynote speaker is going to be Chris Stefanik. Father Jeffrey Kirby is going to be there. Dr. David Anders is going to be there. Steve Dawson. All the apologists here will do the radio show, and we'll have the usual fun that we have. If you want to find out more about it, go to CatholicAnswersConference.com. And if you decide to sign up, use the promo code EARLY, and you save $50. CatholicAnswersConference.com. Use the promo code EARLY. All right. Let's go to New Orleans, Louisiana, where Christian is watching on YouTube. Glad to have you, Christian. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hi.
Hi, Christian.
So I recently read your article on imprimaturs and nihil obstats. And okay. I'm writing a letter to a friend. And I'm trying to help him to understand that just because something has those certifications, it does not make it Catholic doctrine. Mm-hmm. And in that article, you mentioned that it's not a part of the magisterium just because it has an imprimatur nihil obstat. But what confuses me is that according to the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, which you quote in the article, it guarantees, like that's the wording it used, it guarantees mm-hmm. that it's free from error. So how can it give a guarantee mm-hmm. if it's not a part of the magisterium?
Okay, so I'm not sure what article you're referring to, and I don't have it in front of me, and so I'd have to look and see exactly what's said. But so you mentioned two different notes. The first one is the nihil obstat, and the second is the imprimatur. Nihil obstat is Latin for nothing obstructs, and this is typically granted by a censor librorum, a censor of books, and it's a preliminary stage to being granted an imprimatur. An imprimatur is typically granted by the local bishop or the bishop of the place where the book is published, and it goes a little bit beyond what the nihil obstat does. What the nihil obstat does is it's meant, and censors of books are not even members of the magisterium, much less are they the pope, so they're not capable of doing anything infallibly. So nihil obstats are fallible determinations, but what they're meant to do is certify that a book is free from doctrinal or moral error. That means that the book doesn't contain any errors when it comes to how it articulates Catholic doctrine, or it doesn't contain any errors when it comes to how it articulates Catholic moral doctrine. This is different than theology or other matters that the book might deal with. Theology goes beyond doctrine. Theology is all matters of opinion. So, for example, the existence of angels is a matter of doctrine. But if you wanted to say there are 12 kinds of angels, or if you wanted to say there are an even number of angels or an odd number of angels, or angels will always come when you pray for them to, all of those would be matters of theological opinion. And so what the Nihil Obstat would do is, what the Censor of Books would do, and granted a Nihil Obstat, would be to look at the text of the book and say, does anything this book say about doctrine, does it get it wrong? And if the only point of doctrine the book has about angels is that they exist, well, then it gets that right. And so even if it expresses opinions about the number of angels or the kinds of angels or when angels will show up, all that's a matter of opinion. It is not the censor's job to assess those matters. And so you'll even see in a lot of recent books published in the last few decades that have Nihil Obstats and Imprimaturs, it will say that this is meant to certify that the book is free of doctrinal and moral errors, but that doesn't mean that the censor or the bishop agree with everything in the book. They may disagree with it. It just is not a doctrinal or moral error. So assuming the censor grants the Nihil Obstat, meaning nothing obstructs the book from being printed, the censor will then typically make a recommendation to the bishop. And if they recommend that the imprimatur be granted, then the bishop grants an imprimatur, which is Latin for let it be printed. And so it means a little bit more than an imprimatur. It means basically it has some positive value that would recommend it for being a printable work. And that's really all the Nihil Obstat and the imprimatur mean. They are meant, and they don't always get it right. Sometimes they have to retract imprimaturs. But what they're meant to do is say that the book doesn't contain any matters of doctrine that are erroneous, and that's basically it.
I'm going to leave that there. All the lines full. I hope that's helpful to you. Thank you very much, Christian, for the call. Let's go to Helena, Montana, where Maria is listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Maria, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, Jimmy, thanks. I was curious if you could break down the etymology of the word meek. I heard a few different radio personalities express that it means to be prepared like a well-grounded war horse, like a horse that is prepared for any situation and can handle it. But I can't find that in any of my searches that I've done, and I'm not a linguist by any means. So if you could break that down for me, it would be great.
Okay. Well, I'm not sure, and I don't need to know. I'm not sure what radio personalities you're thinking of. I didn't hear them say any such thing. But if they're talking about the etymology of the English word meek, I would be at a loss to explain what they said. The English word meek has a Germanic root, and its exact origins, because of the way English words are influenced by different streams of other Germanic dialects and languages, it can be a little tricky trying to figure out the exact history of the word. But in terms of what the word meek means, it's been used in English since the late 12th century. It means gentle or mild of temper. And it may be derived from the Old Norse word mjukr, which means soft, pliant, or gentle. It's also related to the Gothic Mucha Mode, which means humility, and the Dutch Muk, which means soft. It is perhaps related to a Proto-Indo-European root, Mug, which means slippery or slimy. But ultimately, what a word means is not determined by its etymology, but by its usage. And so even if the word meek did come from a root that means something like equipped or prepared for battle or something like that, that is not what the word meek means in English. And it is not what the word meek means when it's used in the Bible, like in the Beatitudes in Matthew, blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. I'd have to check on what the Greek term that's used there is, but it is also not going to, it's not going to mean equipped for battle. Meaning is determined by usage, not origin. The classic example of that I use to illustrate that point is the word nice. Nice is derived from the Latin word nescius, and nescius means not knowing or ignorant. But if, Sykelet, if you tell your wife that she's wearing a nice dress, you probably don't mean she's wearing an ignorant dress. You mean she's wearing a pleasant dress. And that's because in English, we use the word nice to mean things like pleasant. We don't use it based on its word origins. And to confuse the meaning of a word with where it came from is what's known as the etymological fallacy. Now, there is value to etymology, and it can shed light on the meaning of words. I often look up etymologies, but you have to realize that that's not the ultimate determiner of what a word means. What determines what a word means is how it's actually used in a language community. In any event, it does not appear that the English word meek means anything like equipped or equipped for battle. It appears to come from roots that mean things like soft, pliant, gentle, or humble, stuff like that.
Does that all make sense to you, Maria?
It makes sense, except for the people that I heard referencing it from a well-prepared war horse. I was really attracted to that mm-hmm. definition, and they were other radio personalities on this station, and I really loved that. And so I don't know how mm-hmm. to contact them, because neither of them were necessarily phone in. Well, actually, yeah. Both of them are. They just don't mm-hmm. talk about it as free form that you can just call in.
I see.
Anyway.
Well, I couldn't advise you on that, but I can tell you where you can go to document things like this. There is an excellent online dictionary called the Online Etymology Dictionary that is very helpful for looking up the word origins or the etymologies of English words. And if you just go to etym, it's E-T-Y-M, so etymonline.com. etymonline.com, etymonline.com. You'll get to the Online Etymology Dictionary, or you can just Google Online Etymology Dictionary and it'll come up, and you can type in meek or any other word you want, and it'll come up with a scholarly account of the origins of the word.
Maria, thank you. Thanks very much. On we go. Let's see, where we go. Martha in Houston, Texas, listening on the Guadalupe Radio Network. Martha, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I live in the Archdiocese of Galveston, Houston, and we have a cardinal, Cardinal Daniel DiNardo, who mm-hmm. just retired, and a new bishop will be installed in March. And so my question that I've been wondering about is, will he be eligible for the College of Cardinals whenever he is needed?
As a retired cardinal?
Okay. Retired cardinal. And I also mm-hmm. kind of want to know, do they stay in the diocese, or do they go back to their original home?
All right, Jimmy.
What happens?
Okay, well, any retired bishop is able to, I mean, assuming there's nothing else affecting the situation, any ordinarily retired bishop might choose to stay in the diocese where they serve. They might choose to go back to their home diocese. They might go somewhere else. There are no real requirements or restrictions on where they go under ordinary circumstances if they're a retired diocesan bishop. When it comes to serving in the College of Cardinals, you just because you retire from diocesan service doesn't mean you lose your title as a cardinal. And so Cardinal DiNardo will continue to be a cardinal even once he's no longer serving as a diocesan bishop. He will continue to be eligible to vote in a conclave until he's 80 years old. And even after he's 80 years old, when he would lose the right to vote in a conclave, he would still be a cardinal, and he still has certain prerogatives as a cardinal under canon law. And he also is even welcome to participate in a conclave, like offering advice and perspective and things like that, but he just won't have an active vote in it anymore.
Martha, thank you very much for the call. Lots more calls to come. I'll tell you what, there's one line open. Jimmy Akin is our guest. It's Ask Me Anything. The number, 888-318-7884. We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world. But it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun. And that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that. But he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs. But you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests, he does on-air debates, and he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron.
Deepen your connection to the Church's holy days and seasons while you draw on the wisdom of the Church Fathers. Feasts of Our Fathers, the new book from Mike Aquilina and Adam Lucas, is a treasury of history, prayers, insights, and lessons that will bring you closer to the earliest of Catholic traditions. Take your prayer life and your solidarity with the Church, past and present, to a new level. Order your copy of Feasts of Our Fathers today at shop.catholic.com.
When the resurrected Jesus appeared to disciples on the road to Emmaus, they didn't recognize him until the breaking of the bread. The same is true today. In the Holy Eucharist, we really meet Jesus. In The Eucharist is Really Jesus, author Joe Heschmeyer explains how knowing Jesus in the Eucharist is the key to understanding all of Christian faith. Order your copy of The Eucharist is Really Jesus today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Having a good time. Jimmy Akin is here with us. That's a little bit of groovy music for you. As often happens, all the lines are full when Jimmy's here, and it's an Ask Me Anything. So back we go to the phones. Let's see. Diane is next in Florida, listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Diane, we're awful glad you're here. Go ahead with your question.
Hi. Thanks for being there to take my call. I've come to have the opinion, it's just my opinion lately, mm-hmm. that it doesn't do any good to say that Jesus invites us to do things. To me, I've never seen any place in the Bible where he said, please, would you please do this? I think he always says, do it, and he commands us even. And then also his mother, our Blessed Mother, even said her last words were, do whatever he tells you, and they never were polite, you know, the way we would say, oh, that was an invitation. I'd like to know your opinion about that.
Well, I think that we're dealing with we're dealing with the fact that different languages handle politeness differently. In English, we have the word please, and please is when we use it in a request, like would you pass the salt, please. It's functioning as an adverb that signals politeness. And there are other equivalents to that in other languages, like in Tagalog, for example, which is a language that they speak in the Philippines. They use the word po, and that's their politeness marker. So they would say, you know, they'd say it in Tagalog, but they would say, pass the salt, po. And that's how they signal that this is polite. On the other hand, even when you have a politeness marker, it doesn't mean that you're not given an order. If you ever watch the Gilbert and Sullivan operetta, the HMS Pinafore, which is set in the British Navy in the 19th century, Captain Corcoran will give instructions to his crew, but to be polite, he will always say, if you please. So he might say, swab the deck, if you please. But it would be a mistake to confuse that with just a request to wash the deck coming from the captain. That's an order. He's just phrasing it in a politeness manner by using if you please as a politeness marker. Now, other languages don't use politeness markers the same way we do in English. One of the things I've been struck by in reading Latin prayers is they use what's called the imperative mood to make requests of God. So like if you look in the Lord's Prayer in Latin, and you just look at the grammatical forms that are being used, it will say things like, you know, your kingdom come, your will be done, give us this day our daily bread. Now, you'll notice even in English, there's no politeness marker there. We don't say, give us this day our daily bread, please, or anything like that, or forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. It doesn't say, forgive us our debts, please. And in Latin, they just use the imperative mood for this. In English, we use the imperative mood for commands. And that's what we principally think of the imperative mood as doing. But it doesn't have to be a command. It can also be a request. And this is even more the case in Latin, which doesn't have the same politeness markers that we use in English. So actually, when you're reading a prayer in Latin, it can sound kind of brusque, like you're commanding God, you know, do this, do that. But it's not meant that way. That's a misreading of it that's due to an insensitivity to the way that Latin handles politeness. It's just different than the way English handles politeness. Now, in Greek and in Aramaic, you know, they may or may not have had politeness markers, but even if they did, and I know like in Hebrew, they did. Na is a Hebrew politeness marker. So when it means the same thing as please. So like when we say Hosanna, Hosan it's derived from the same root as save. And so when you say Hosanna, it's a polite, you're saying save, please. It's a request, and it's meant to be a polite request. That's why you're including the na. I'd have to check to see what politeness markers were available in Aramaic, and in New Testament Greek. I'm not thinking of politeness markers off the top of my head, but there may have been some. But even if there were, that doesn't mean they would use them as frequently as we do. So I think we have to be a little careful in just noting that they don't always use politeness markers and thinking, oh, therefore everything they say must be a command. Well, in fact, we have at least we have doctrinal evidence as opposed to exegetical evidence that that Jesus does invite people to do things on occasion. There are what are known as the vocations, you know, the vocation to marriage, the vocation to the religious life, the vocation to the ordained life. There are also the evangelical councils, you know, the classically poverty, chastity, and obedience. And those are associated with the religious life. Well, okay, all vocations have to be freely chosen. God does not command one person to be married and command another person to be religious and command another person to be ordained. Those are vocations by which a person can serve God, but they have to be freely accepted. And so God never commands people to adopt one of these vocations. He shows them an opportunity by which they could serve him. But he doesn't require them morally to embrace that vocation. And same thing when it comes to the evangelical councils, the kind of poverty, chastity, and obedience that one embraces, if one embraces the evangelical councils, goes beyond the basic requirements of morality. Now, there is a certain kind of chastity that everyone is expected to have, but the kind of chastity and the voluntary embrace of poverty, the voluntary embrace of obedience when it goes beyond what would otherwise be required, those go beyond standard morality, and therefore they're voluntary. That's why these are called evangelical councils as opposed to commands. So we do have quite strong evidence between the vocations and the councils that God does invite people to do some things. Now, he commands people to do some things, but we also have strong indication that he also invites people to do some things. So I wouldn't see this as an either or, but as a both and.
I'm going to leave that there because, Diane, we've got lots and lots of folks on the line. But thank you very much for the call and for the question. Stephen's in San Antonio, Texas, also listening on the Guadalupe Radio Network. Stephen, we're glad you're here. Go ahead with your question.
Okay, it's more of an objection and a question, I guess. I think you were wrong on the first caller. I do.
Okay.
I think that it is. Yeah, I think that... he was asking, you know, if they invent the technology that would let you live indefinitely. You said it's nothing immoral about it, but I think there is immoral.
Okay.
Here's my reason. Okay. Mm-hmm. I think it's immoral because it's unnatural. God did not design us to live in our sinful nature indefinitely. He allowed us to live, how does it go? The soul that sinneth shall die. We're allowed to live definitely for a definite amount of time in our sin. And that's it, not indefinitely. And plus, I think we're also playing God by doing this. He wants to give us life indefinitely, which is eternal life. Mm-hmm. And we're trying to play God by living indefinitely without him through technology. And so these are my objections. I think it is unnatural because naturally we're supposed to live only a definite amount of time, not indefinite amount of time. And it's like we're going against his will for our existence in our sinful state. So that's
okay, so you put a number of issues on the table there. Let me go through them, and I need you to help me out if I forget any of them. So the first argument that it's unnatural to live forever is something that I would agree with in a specific sense. Any natural system is going to break down over time. That's because the universe is subject to entropy. And this is something that's not new. St. Thomas Aquinas pointed this out, that he didn't have the term entropy, but he did talk about corruption. And so any natural system that's not supported by grace is going to corrupt over time, in Aquinas's language. And therefore, the immortality that God had given Adam and Eve before the fall, that was unnatural. It went beyond nature. But that didn't make it wrong. And God will ultimately restore all of us to a state of immortality. And that's not going to be wrong. It's also not the same thing as what I was talking about, because I was asked about a technology that extends life indefinitely, but that doesn't mean you're not going to fall off a cliff and die. It doesn't mean you're not going to be stabbed and murdered someday. It's not true immortality. That's something we don't know how to achieve, because that really does go beyond nature. And we can't go beyond nature. What God has given us the ability to do is work with nature to extend life. And so in working with nature to extend life, we are not doing anything unnatural. We would just be exploiting abilities that are resident within nature that God has given us the intellects to crack. And just like we can use our intellects to ameliorate other aspects of human suffering by working within nature, if we found a way to dramatically extend human life, even indefinitely, by working with nature, then we wouldn't be doing anything unnatural. Okay, so that's the first issue. You then started talking about living apart from God and you're changing the equation then. Just like I discussed with the first caller, you're introducing new conditions that are not part of the original question. I wasn't asked, is it wrong to try to live forever without God? If that was the question I'd been asked, I would have said, of course it is. We all need to live with God. And if you're trying to evade the divine reality by living forever, you need to get your priorities straightened out. On the other hand, if you are someone who's living a life in harmony with God and you're able to work within nature to extend that life indefinitely, then the objection of living without God does not apply in this case. So again, that's changing the initial question. Also, we're not going to be evading God indefinitely, because he is coming back someday. And when he, you know, there's nothing wrong with living till the second coming. St. Paul even expects it in 1 Thessalonians 4. He talks about how when Jesus comes back, then we who are alive and remain will be transformed. And he's expecting to live to the second coming himself in his own life, because the length of the church age had not yet been revealed. It later was in the first century. John became aware there would be this lengthy period symbolized by 1,000 years before the end of the world. But some Christians are going to be alive until the second day and until the second coming. And when that day arrives, everybody's going to get judged. And if you're on the side, if you're on team God's friends, then you'll be transformed in a good way. If you're on team not God's friends, things aren't going to go well for you, but you're not going to be evading God either way. All we're talking about doing is extending your life into some unknown length. And if it happens to go up to the second coming, well, then you're just one of those people who live till the second coming. There's nothing wrong with living till the second coming. So that hits several of the aspects of what you brought up. Did I forget to address any of the points that you brought up, Stephen?
No, you addressed them all, I believe.
Okay, awesome. Thank you for calling in. Always happy to entertain objections.
Thank you, Stephen. That takes us to the break. We'll be right back with more Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
This is Archbishop Paul Coakley, the Archdiocese of Oklahoma City, and you're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Who was the first Catholic in your family? Were they evangelized by a friend, a coworker, a stranger? Did you ever think that you could be that person that God uses to save a soul, and that soul could save their family, their grandchildren, and generations to come? At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we train, equip, and mobilize Catholic disciples to do the urgent work of evangelization. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization, streetevangelization.com.
Wings is a weekly newsletter that's packed with program information, features, and updates of all that's going on at EWTN. To sign up, go to EWTN.com, click subscribe, enter your name and email address, and you'll start getting your wings every week. Get your wings today. It's the weekly newsletter from EWTN, the Global Catholic Network.
Jimmy Akin is our guest. It's Ask Me Anything. I asked Jimmy about what dropped today on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, but I forgot on Mondays. I forgot to ask about Monday, because on Monday, of course, the Jimmy Akin podcast dropped. What dropped on Monday?
Well, this last Monday, I had an episode responding to some arguments made by Gavin Ortlund. Gavin Ortlund is a Protestant apologist. He's a Reformed Baptist. He's a real nice guy. But he had made some arguments regarding principally the papacy, but they also deal with sola scriptura and so forth. And someone had asked me what I thought of them. And so I did a video responding to him. And it's been a very popular video. People have really liked it. This coming Monday, I have a video coming out on the mystery of the heart and how it's used in how the image of the heart is used in the Bible and in church documents, and how it does or doesn't quite square with science, or does it after all?
Oh, fascinating. All right, that one will come Monday. A new episode of the Jimmy Akin podcast drops each Monday, and you can find it on Jimmy's YouTube channel or wherever you get your podcasts. All right, we are moving through. Well, we have one line open. I should let you know that. So if you've been waiting for me to say there's a line open, go ahead and call now, 888-318-7884. Jeff is in Tennessee listening on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. That's EWTN on Sirius XM. Jeff, go ahead with your question.
Hey, Si, you know, you're almost my favorite apologist.
Oh, well, thank you, Jeff. Thank you very much.
Do you want to know who my favorite is?
I have a feeling I know, but who is your favorite?
Joe Heschmeyer.
Oh, my God. I thought it was going to be Jimmy Akin.
Oh, well, then, Jeff, you're welcome to call back in on one of Joe's days.
Joe's
nice
on,
talking with you.
Joe's on each Wednesday, Jeff.
You know, I called one time before with this question, and they advised me to call back for Jimmy.
Okay, well, give him the question.
Well, just a politeness tip. It's great to praise people and that you appreciate, but when you start to do comparative praising, and you're asking someone for something, you don't want to lead. It's not a good opener in a negotiation where you're asking for something to say, by the way, you're not my favorite, but help me with this, please.
Well, can you help me with this, then?
I will do my best.
All right, so a while back I had seen a thing on Instagram where the previous president was bestowed with an honorary Freemasonry title or membership or whatever. And as I understand it, as Catholics, we're not to be members of a secret society, so to speak. So,
no.
A, how is that possible for him to accept that? And then B, I don't understand the difference between Freemasonry and, you know, and like say Knights of Columbus, where the Knights of Columbus have some secrecy to it as far as initiation to the different degrees in the knights.
All right.
So I don't understand the difference there.
Yeah, okay. So the first thing is the law does not require Catholics to not be members of a secret society. What the law requires, this is in the current Code of Canon Law, is that Catholics not be members of societies that plot to undermine the church. And well, the Knights of Columbus don't plot to undermine the church. They plot to help the church. So that's the fundamentally relevant thing here. Now, should the former president have accepted this from a Masonic lodge? Well, I would say no. There are the Vatican has repeatedly indicated that Catholics are not supposed to be Masons. They should not be accepting memberships, honorary or otherwise, in Masonic lodges. I didn't hear that it was honorary. I thought it was just a membership. But even if it was honorary, they still shouldn't be accepting them. If for no other reason, even if they don't take it seriously because of the scandal that it will involve other Catholics in, it'll lead them to think, oh, well, I can be a Mason too. Now, what would the canonical consequences be of him having accepted such a membership? Well, that's harder to say, in particular because of the issues of mental competency that are, you know, became publicly manifest towards the end of his tenure. There would be a strong case that you can't really hold this guy accountable for all of the decisions he's making. And so that would have a mitigating effect on any canonical consequences he had for accepting a Masonic membership when he shouldn't have. In terms of what's the difference between the Knights and Columbus, well, they are both organizations that have certain aspects of secrecy with them, but that's true of everything. Every organization has proprietary information and things that it doesn't share. I mean, the Vatican does. That's what the apostolic secret is. There are various things that are under the apostolic secret that Vatican officials are not allowed to talk about publicly. Like, you're not going to get a detailed health report on every little thing going on, you know, in a papal health emergency. You'll get a basic press release maybe, but you're not going to get, they don't just spill the Pope's medical records open for public inspection. And so that's just one example of numerous things that are reasonable to not just put online for everyone to read, that every organization has. When it comes to the Knights of Columbus, they did used to have a secret oath for joining, but that's been changed. And I for one was very glad when they changed it, that and no longer had it be a secret oath, because I always thought it was foolish of them to have it be a secret oath, because that's just an invitation for people to wonder about, oh, what's in the secret Knights of Columbus oath? And there were anti-Catholics who made stuff up and claimed, oh, this is the real Knights of Columbus oath, where they swear to do all these evil things in support of the Catholic Church. And there was no way for Knights of Columbus to refute that if they can't tell you what the oath is. So I always thought that was stupid to have a secret oath. And they changed that a few years ago. And I was like, yes, finally, good for you guys. So basically, the Knights of Columbus are a Catholic men's service organization. They have a variety of functions. They do various good works. They have, you know, insurance. They have occasions for fellowship. They do a bunch of different good things. And they're rooted in the 19th century, when it was all the big rage here in America, which is where the Knights of Columbus originated. That's why they're called the Knights of Columbus, Columbia meaning the Americas. And it was the rage here in the 19th century for men to have men's clubs where they would get together and they would put on silly costumes and they would have secret handshakes and they would have secret oaths and they would have passwords and they would have secret ceremonies. And this was the big thing. This was the fun thing for people to do. And so the Knights of Columbus did that. The Ku Klux Klan did that. The Odd Fellows did that. The Masons did that. This was just the Elks did that. This is just a standard thing for men to do at the time. But we're living in a different day and age now, and the Knights of Columbus have developed to the point that they no longer have the same kind of secrecy, which I think is a great thing, and that allows people to focus more on the positive and the good works that they do.
Jeff, thank you very much. I don't know if it's for political reasons, Jimmy, or if there's a sensitivity about it. I know she did not mention the Loyal Order of the Buffalo as one of the secrets. Is that too secret to get into?
Well, you know, I'd have to check with the Grand Poobah.
Yes, the Grand Poobah. I love those Loyal Order of the Buffalo hats. Mm-hmm. I want one of those. And by the way, my birthday.
You know what that kind of hat would be called?
What?
A Shako.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, it's like the hats you see on British guards in
palace. Yeah,
it's a shako. They just got the little water buffalo horns on them.
Yes. If you don't know about the Loyal Order of the Buffalo, well, maybe it's too top secret for you to know about it. I don't know. You could search the internet, see if they have anything about it, but I'm not going to talk about it. Jimmy Akin is our guest. We're going to take a very quick break and come right back. Every single phone line is full, but often during these top of the hour breaks, one or two lines will open up. So give it a try if you'd like to ask Jimmy a question. 888-318-7884 is the number. 888-318-7884.